government-backed anti-Islamist crackdown on Muslim-majority schools in Birmingham have issued fresh demands for justice after a new investigation revealed that the government may have acted against them based on bogus extremism threat claims. A podcast series published by the New York Times titled The Trojan Horse Affair alleges that numerous players, including Government Minister Michael Gove, penalized several schools and their staff, despite knowing the accusations weren't credible.
Knowing all of these facts and background, he went on to launch an offensive against our schools and brought down what were, you know, highly successful schools within a matter of months. This was a clear abuse of authority and abuse of power, for which I think that people should be held to account.
The Trojan Horse affair began in 2014 after a mysterious letter was sent anonymously to Birmingham Council. The letter outlined a supposed plot by Muslim extremists to infiltrate, take over and radicalize schools. On the back of the letter, inquiries were launched, followed by an Islamophobic media frenzy, which then led to several Muslim teachers being sacked or banned from their work.
What we observed and we witnessed this firsthand was institutional racism, institutional corruption, and institutional Islamophobia. The media had a social responsibility to ensure that there was a balance and a reporting of facts, but this was not the case.
The Muslims targeted say they are victims of a state-backed witch hunt and that the extremism accusations were devastating.
I was unable to get any job. I was even refused voluntary posts. People wouldn't even accept my voluntary work because my name and personality had been stigmatized, I've been vilified, and the label of extremism and radicalism had been attached to my name. So it made me unemployable, quite frankly.
I would also say to Michael Gove, damages and compensation are due, and my ban and the ban of my fellow colleagues need to be lifted immediately.
After spending the day here in Birmingham, it's very clear that the negative effects that the Trojan Horse affair has had on the Muslim community still resonates very strongly. And with the victims' hunger for justice as strong now as it's ever been, the question is, what will be done to hold those who did any wrongdoing during the affair to account going forward? Robert Carter, Birmingham.
Sadhika, a 12th grade student in New Delhi, is outraged. She says it could perhaps be the first time in Indian history a particular community is being targeted for what they wear. Earlier, it would be our mosques, what we eat, our marriages, our personal laws. Now it's what we wear.
Being an Indian, we are very proud to be here. And we feel like every human being has a right to decide. They have their own choice. We don't need to interfere between their choices. The constitution also gives us right there like that.
Last week, a video circulating on social media became a sensation within a few hours. A young college student from the southern Indian state of Karnataka was heckled by a group of saffron-clad Hindu students chanting slogans hailing Hindu deity Rama. The girl responded back with a similar reaction, chanting Allah Akbar, which means God is great. The incident blazed the public sentiments, with many calling the girl lioness, while others hailed her an iron lady. As India's state elections are underway, experts say polarizing the voters is a common phenomenon in India, with religion being the easy tool.
All effort is to try to erase Muslims from public places and to prevent them from being seen in public and impose apartheid on Muslim women. They are trying to achieve that target, but it's not as easy as they are thinking.
Another college student who spoke on the condition of anonymity said the ruling BJP might rewrite the constitution, considering their policies and actions they are imposing in a country.
It's the personal choice of a person to wear whatever they want to do, and according to constitution, we have the rights. It's totally a sad thing, and it's really like particularly targeting a particular community due to which we start living in a threat.
Ban on Islamic hand scarves has outraged the Muslim community, saying it's an outright attack on their faith, which the constitution guarantees to safeguard. They say it could perhaps be an attempt to prevent Muslim women from attaining education or to flare communal tensions amid elections. Observers say anti-Muslim rhetoric has flared aggressively since BJP formed the government in 2014. They say since 2014, most of the elections in India were overly polarized. Religious divide has been the main triumph card of the current administration. Based on rights groups, the ruling BJP has adopted various laws and policies that legitimize violence and targeting religious minorities. Experts say it's a larger political agenda to make India a supremacist Hindu nation. Meanwhile, protesting student groups have defended the use of hijab, saying the constitution guarantees them religious freedom. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
People from all walks of life held a rally Monday in front of the Red Cross office in Gaza to support Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. They protested Tel Aviv's inhumane treatment of thousands of Palestinian political prisoners, especially those held under administrative detention. The event is part of a week-long national campaign in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners. This as Palestinian prisoners observed a one-day hunger strike on Monday in all Israeli prisons.
We are here to send a message of solidarity to administrative detainees and to all the prisoners. We will not let the prisoners down, and we will spare no effort to release them. We also call on all international agencies to stop Israeli crimes against Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners suffer from inhumane treatment inside Israeli jails and are denied basic rights. Last month alone, Israeli regime forces arrested 504 Palestinians, including 50 children.
We are here to call on Palestinian resistance factions to support the prisoners and exert pressure on the Zionist regime to release them. Our enemy doesn't want peace and only understands the language of force and the language of armed resistance.
Rights activists say Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails will continue to suffer as long as the world turns a blind eye to Tel Aviv's violations of their rights.
Administrative detainees are currently boycotting Israeli courts because their detention is illegal. They are being held under secret evidence under inhumane conditions. Administrative detention is an Israeli policy to make prisoners suffer.
Palestinian administrative detainees are being held without charge or trial, while their incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely.
Currently, the Israeli regime keeps more than 500 Palestinian prisoners under administrative detention, including women and minors. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
The meeting between Vladimir Putin and Olaf Scholz was the first since Scholz's appointment as the German chancellor. During the talks, Putin called Germany one of Russia's main partners. The leaders touched upon the issue of Russia's proposals for security guarantees. The Russian president stressed that Moscow cannot turn a blind eye to how freely the United States and NATO interpret the principles of the indivisibility of security, noting that the expansion of the North Atlantic alliance to the east continues, despite the assurances of Western partners.
About the expansion of NATO, here you said a wonderful phrase. They say that Ukraine will not be in NATO in the coming years. What does they say mean? You and I must understand what is spoken in interstate relations. We have been told for 30 years that there will be no NATO expansion at all, not one inch towards the Russian borders. And today we see the NATO infrastructure right at our house.
Putin added the postponement of Ukraine's entry into the bloc will not change anything, and Moscow would like to resolve this issue now. Speaking about the escalation in Ukraine, the Russian leader called what is happening in the Donbas a genocide. On February 9th, Olaf Scholz noted that Germany is ready for dialogue with Russia at all levels and in all possible formats for the sake of a political settlement. At the same time, he stressed that Moscow should not underestimate the cohesion and determination of Germany's NATO allies.
As for the situation with the negotiations, the positions differ, but it's important that we talk to each other. The proposals that were formulated by Russia, we also do not agree with them. NATO and the EU do not agree, but they also contain points that we are ready to talk about and are ready to discuss. Now it is necessary that a dangerous situation does not arise.
The German chancellor noted that positions of the West and Russian security guarantees diverge, but the issue of Ukraine's membership in NATO is not on the agenda. This is while statements that Russia is preparing to invade Ukraine continue to come from the West, an allegation vehemently denied by Moscow. Germany, as an important member of NATO, could influence its partners in the bloc, who, judging by their actions, are set up for a conflict with Russia. Moscow is not satisfied with semitones and ambiguities in matters of security guarantees. Their clear fixation is necessary. Only thanks to this it is possible to achieve a diffusion of tension, which is in the interests of Germany, located in the center of Europe. Marina Kartonova, Moscow.
Another bloody day has been witnessed in the occupied West Bank, this time in Jenin. 17-year-old Palestinian teen Mohammed Abu Salah was killed in the village of Silat al-Harithiya as Israeli troops raided the town on Sunday night to demolish the home of Palestinian prisoner Mahmoud Jaradat. Dozens of Palestinians were injured by live ammunition and rubber bullets fired by the Israeli forces towards the protesters who rushed to the area to prevent the demolition. Mahmoud Jaradat is a prisoner accused of carrying out shooting last December that led to the killing of an Israeli settler near the illegal settlement of Homish.
What my dad did is a heroic act. It's a very sad and painful feeling to see our home destroyed, but we don't want to show the Israelis that we are sad. We can rebuild the home.
The Israeli forces raided the village and immediately opened fire at the protesters because youths gathered to protest the demolition. A number of them were wounded and one was killed while defending Jaradat's home. And after a few hours, the Israeli soldiers blew up the house with dynamite.
Tension continues to remain high for the third consecutive day in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. Clashes have been breaking out between Palestinian residents of the neighborhood and Israeli settlers and soldiers. Paramedics say over 30 Palestinians have been injured. A dozen others were also detained. The clashes came shortly after Israeli far-right Knesset member Itamar Ben-Gavir announced that he would be setting up an office in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood to protect the settlers. Ben-Gavir had erected a tent in the front yard of Salem family home, another family in Sheikh Jarrah facing imminent expulsion.
The Israeli extremist Knesset member is leading a campaign to allow settlers to take over Palestinian homes in Sheikh Jarrah. The Israeli regime is giving him full support. While Palestinians are defending their presence in Sheikh Jarrah and resisting the Israeli project to wipe out their existence.
Several Palestinian families in Sheikh Jarrah face potential eviction by settler organizations, all following last year's tensions and the May war between the Israeli regime and armed groups in the Gaza Strip. Observers today warned that Israel's continued aggression against Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood and its escalating violence across the occupied territories could be the spark that sets the entire region ablaze. Because at the end of the day, Palestinians say they will remain steadfast and Tel Aviv's violence will not stop them from defending their rights. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon his word, and I cling only to his cord. In thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For thou art Allah, the best guardian, and thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The recent revelations about the Trojan Horse scandal, a hoax plan for so-called extremists to take over a number of British schools, highlight the issue of institutionalized Islamophobia in the UK, and how victims of the government-backed Islamophobic purge are calling for justice and a fresh, independent inquiry. In this edition of Spotlight, we'll look at the different aspects of this scandal, as well as the role and goals of the British government in promoting Islamophobia.
The Muslim Council of Britain has demanded an independent public inquiry be launched to get to the bottom of who was behind the hoax extremism plot letter which ruined the lives of so many Muslim teachers. The call comes amid rising pressure on Government Minister Michael Gove, who was named and shamed as a key component which turned the bogus plot into a nationwide Islamophobic witch hunt in Birmingham.
It all started when a letter detailing an alleged extremism plot to take over and radicalise Muslim-majority schools in Birmingham was circulated by the press. Mr Gove, who was in office at the time, was aware of the letter, was warned that it's a hoax, yet decided to disregard the advice and pushed ahead with it anyway, adding fuel to the fire. It's believed that it might be his own personal prejudices against Muslims that fueled this decision, based on the fact that he's written material in the past that's been considered deeply Islamophobic.
Press TV spoke to several victims of the witch hunt earlier this week. They are hopeful for legal retribution.
The allegations against us were based on hearsay. The statements that were given by anonymous witnesses weren't substantiated, they weren't corroborated. Yet on the back of these allegations, our careers and lives were ruined and we were ostracized. I was ostracized, demonized, vilified. Seen as the bad guy.
A public apology for his actions, followed by a change in policy, because the actions that followed what was perceived to be a sinister plot on part of Muslim teachers, governors, and I was included within that bracket, that all of that was a complete fabrication and a lie. And so there has to be a public apology, and B, a rescinding of the policies that subsequently followed.
Apart from the racist and Islamophobic aspects at play, the Trojan Horse scandal was used as a pretext to enforce controversial counter-extremism policies which have penalised Muslims ever since. Press TV contacted Mr Gove's office for comment but received no reply. But with demands for answers growing, how long can the silence remain? Robert Carter, London.
Joining us on Spotlight, we have Secretary General of the European Muslim League, Ms. Yvonne Ridley, joining us from Jedburgh, and Head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajari, who's joining us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's start with Yvonne Ridley in Jedburgh. Ms. Ridley, it's great to have you with us. It's been years since we last spoke. So demands for an independent inquiry into Britain's Trojan Horse scandal have grown after this podcast recently highlighted several unanswered questions from the entire saga. So after so many years, why are there still so many unanswered questions?
Well, because as we've already heard in that excellent report by Robert Carter, that the whole Trojan Horse affair was one big hoax. But it didn't stop the government and ministers like Michael Gove acting as though this was a very real threat. And as a result, decisions taken affected all of the state-funded education in England and Wales. And there was a McCarthy-style witch hunt. But instead of people looking for reds under the bed, they were seeing Muslim extremists where there were none. Like all injustices, the Trojan Horse affair cast a long shadow over Muslim communities. And the real losers were people like the one that we just heard, whose lives and careers were ruined by the Trojan Horse affair. But also the long-term losers have been Muslim children in those schools, not just in Birmingham. This is right across England. I spoke to somebody today who was a school governor in Bradford who was edged out because people were seeing extremists everywhere where there were actually none. This whole affair has damaged people's lives, damaged careers, damaged the education in England and Wales. It's been very destructive. It's cast a very long shadow, and the government must be held to account. Good that the Muslim Council of Britain is calling for justice, but also ordinary members of the public have taken it upon themselves to sign a petition and try and force the issue to be debated in the House of Commons.
Master Chajare, in 2017, the cases against the teachers collapsed, but their defense has never been heard to this day. Who should be responsible for this? Who should compensate, basically, the individuals that bore the brunt of this fabricated scenario? Despite numerous government reports, parliamentary hearings, and an array of legal processes, why has the truth been so hard to pin down?
Well, what was being accused was that the Muslim community or certain members of Muslim community are coordinating, organizing to take over the education and divert and brainwash the children, not just Muslim children, but children. But the reality was that the only people who were getting together to converse and create a coordinated effort to do damage and do unlawful things was Mr. Gove and his colleagues. You know, he brought Peter Clark, which was the ex-head of the anti-terrorism of Metropolitan Police, with no expertise in trying to actually unleash whatever was happening or what was being accused within the schools. But his expertise was to always see a Muslim wrongdoers around the corner. And this is why he was brought in. I mean, it is very important to remind the viewers that what happened prior to this was these schools which were turned around. They were failing schools. They were turned around by this team of dedicated Muslims, not just for the Muslim children, but for everyone. So here was actually a solution to the problems of education in inner cities, which the Muslims rose up and start addressing. And actually, they were commanded for this. And then because of a fraud, someone took a position of writing a false letter. And everyone, Gove as a minister and indeed everybody else in authority, jumped on that bandwagon and demonized the whole of the Muslim community, disassociated Muslims for being involved in the future of the children, their children, and indeed other children. And that sort of process of helping the education within inner city, turning failing schools into actually a proper school, was totally lost to the Muslim children and indeed everybody else. And I would say that on top of the fact that we have to blame the institutionalized Islamophobia, which is definitely behind this, we also have to blame the Muslim community and Muslim community institutions, because they failed to rise up and help and support not just these teachers, but stop the demonization of whole of the Muslim community. Their failure at the time, it really is very worrying. You know, when you compare the currently Sikh council sort of on the immigration bill, turning around to all the members of parliament and saying that anyone who's voted for this racist bill will be welcome to go into any of the temples, the Muslim councils actually failed misery to support and indeed stand up against this institutional Islamophobia.
Ms. Ridley, you were nodding there when we were listening to Mr. Shajet. How do you perceive the role of the government in this scandal? And more importantly, what was the end result of it?
Well, I agreed with most of what Masood said, but I wouldn't blame the Muslim community. The Muslims in Britain, ever since 9/11, have been put under the cosh. There's been paranoia displayed towards Muslims. Islamophobia has been fueled, and this race hate has really been directed at the Muslim community. Muslims back in that period, about a decade after 9/11, they felt under fire and had lost a lot of the confidence that they used to have. So when there was this deluge of criticism directed towards the schools about these Muslim fundamentalists creeping into the education system and trying to push extremist views onto the children, they just believed it. And, of course, it was one big lie pushed conveniently by Michael Gove, who was one of the most Islamophobic ministers in this government, a government which has a reputation these days for pushing out lies on an almost daily basis. But what is also important in this, while Michael Gove was pushing this, he also used this fake letter as an excuse to roll out some extreme counter-terrorism measures, such as the notorious, now discredited, Prevent strategy in schools, which turned every teacher, every teaching assistant, even parents into spies, which again undermined the confidence of the community.
Indeed.
You know, children were, any children that showed, say, support for Palestine were reported to the Prevent scheme. Millions of pounds was poured into this discredited scheme while the education budgets were creaking along and not able to perform. So there was a big domino effect in this, but I wouldn't blame the Muslim community as a whole.
Okay, Mr. Shajet, you can also respond to that. That's exactly where I was going next. As a result of the government responded by implementing the so-called anti-terrorism prevent strategy in schools, it also made it a requirement for all schools to promote fundamental British values. Is religious intolerance being promoted in Britain?
Well, unfortunately, we know that this government, and indeed the rest of Europe, the governments, and we are seeing sort of similar thing happening in France, Germany, and elsewhere. There is institutional Islamophobia, and the demonization of Muslim has become the norm. And we are in this environment of hate against Muslims. The problem is this, that, there is amnesia within those who are head of the so-called leadership of the Muslim community. Every time any incident happens, there seems to be somebody comes and push a button of reset button, and we forget about everything that has happened in past, and we're forgetting that we are living in this environment, and then we get letters from the Muslim Council of writing to MPs and thanking them. I don't know for what, for the fact that they're not addressing the ever-increasing Islamophobia. We need to be extremely critical of this Islamophobic government, which is actually more Islamophobic than previous one, and there's no doubt about that. But at the same time, we need to actually be internally criticizing ourselves, because our institutions are not fit for purpose. They still want to rub shoulder, and they think that they get influence by having a cup of tea or rubbing shoulders with a minister or two. And I think, you know, Ivan knows this very well. I remember, Ivan, you raised that once in a meeting before to one of the very senior police officers. You know this, I know this, and unless we tackle this, unless we actually stand up with the situation is as bad as it is now, we need to be fit for that purpose. And that means we need to stand up not just for protecting the Muslim community, which needs to be protected, but the whole community, because this environment of hate is so poisonous that actually affects everyone, Muslims and non-Muslims. See what happened in former Yugoslavia. See what has happened previously in other structures when these level of demonization have been unchecked.
Ms. Ridley, the effects of such affairs, such sagas, they are all-encompassing. 8 years on, this Trojan horse affair remains perhaps the best known and most polarizing story about Britain's relationship with its Muslim citizens. What have the British public, Muslim and non-Muslim alike, learned from all of this?
Well, sadly, I would think that the majority of the British public outside of the Muslim community are not aware of this excellent Trojan Horse podcast, which has been produced by the New York Times. Why is it that this excellent piece of investigative journalism and great expose has come from America? Because it should have come from the British media. But unfortunately, the British media is also institutionally racist and Islamophobic. And, you know, this is where we have a problem. And what I would like to see the Muslim community do, not necessarily through the leadership of the MCB or any of these other Muslim organizations, is start to stand up. As I've often said, if you get up off your knees and stand up, the so-called great don't seem that great from that position. And so the Muslim community needs to get its confidence back. Maybe we should take a lead from the black communities in Brixton and in Toxteth. They got a lot of justice back through riots. I'm not suggesting Muslims rise up and take to the streets. You know, we have other mechanisms and other ways of making our points known. But maybe we should take a zero tolerance lead from the black community and be vocal and be robust and demand our rights. You know, human rights are for everyone in Britain, not just a few. And so this is something that we need to get a confidence back in the Muslim community. That's what we need.
Mr. Shajare, is the British mainstream media Islamophobic? Does it promote Islamophobia?
Yes, of course it does. They're promoting Islamophobia in many ways. And the fact that this sort of a story doesn't break out, the fact that, you know, even when it breaks out, you know, nobody is calling for resignation of Gove, which if it was, if the same treatment was dished out to any other community, they would have been call for resignation, and shrinking spaces. Sort of 10, 20 years ago, a Muslim community as a whole had a more voice, a very diverse voice in the British media. Now it doesn't, and now it's even sort of Zionists speaking on behalf of the Muslims and everybody else, racist. So I actually agree with what Ivan is saying. We need to be more confident in ourselves. The last conference, which was in January on Islamophobia conference, which we held, we looked at how we could work with the establishment. Should we work with them? Yes, no, maybe. And we looked at the historical, and indeed we looked at the experience of the black community, and we looked at it from a theological basis and everything. We need to revive the right of standing up to the bullies, because the bullies are taking over, and the government and the media are part of that bullying.
All right, thanks a lot. That's all the time we have for tonight's program. Allow me to thank my guests for the show tonight, Secretary General of the European Muslim League, Ms. Yvonne Ridley, joining us from JEDBRO, also head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajere, speaking to us from the British capital, London. And also a special thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In March 2010, with Tea Party activists protesting loudly in the hallways of Capitol Hill and the political wind in their faces, 34 House Democrats, including Representative Stephen Lynch of Massachusetts, broke with their president to vote against passage of the Affordable Care Act. The news analysis you're about to hear has been written by Jonathan Wiseman, who is congressional correspondent and a veteran New York Times journalist. The piece is titled Painful Changes in Society Ease Passage of Bold Safety Net Measures. March 2010, with Tea Party activists protesting loudly in the hallways of Capitol Hill and the political wind in their faces, 34 House Democrats, including Representative Stephen Lynch of Massachusetts, broke with their president to vote against passage of the Affordable Care Act. It was not enough to kill the bill, but more than enough to register deep concerns about its reach in American society and its potential impact on the midterm elections. On Friday, 19th of November 2021, Stephen Lynch and every other Democrat but one cast votes for about $2 trillion in spending on social welfare and climate change programs that arguably go much further than the health law, further, in fact, than any government intervention in half a century. And the concerns that peeled so many Democrats away from the health measure more than a decade ago were hardly in evidence, at least on their side of the aisle. I've served a couple of times in the minority, a couple of times in the majority, said Mr. Lynch, the last remaining House Democrat who voted against Barack Obama's signature domestic achievement. I've got a better sense of time and how these moments are rare when you can seize on something and make real change. The political and economic shifts in the United States in the decade between the first vote and the second may explain how a party still divided could unite around legislation of such sweep. The worst public health crisis in a century laid bare economic stagnation in the middle class and the soaring wealth of the super rich in America. The recovery from the coronavirus crisis is still held back by childcare costs and poor educational access that have kept parents home instead of working. Searing heat waves, record wildfires, and waves battering hurricanes have underlined the reality of climate change, and the killings of black men and women captured on video and spread instantly around the world raised awareness of racial injustice and inequality, just as new generation of progressives was rising up in the Democratic Party. I've always said, courage comes out of crisis, said Representative Pramila Jayapal, Democrat of Washington and the leader of the nearly 100-member Congressional Progressive Caucus. You just couldn't ignore this stuff anymore. It was intolerable to watch. Those forces appeared to unite Democrats as they made their way to the Capitol to vote. There were no shouts from angry opponents like the ones that greeted Democrats in 2010 as they prepared to approve the Affordable Care Act. The main barrier to passage was an 8-hour speech by the House Republican leader, Representative Kevin McCarthy of California. Beyond the chamber, the only activists in evidence were a small clutch of supporters singing old union songs and someone dressed like the Build Back Better Act, modeled after the bill in the old Schoolhouse Rock video. The social safety net and climate bill still must navigate a tortuous road through the evenly divided Senate, where a single defection would bring it down. If it is able to clear that chamber, it most likely will have to go back to the House for a final vote, devoid of some of its items that drew Democrats to support it on Friday. But if it is enacted, it will touch virtually every American life, from birth to death, akin to Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal or Lyndon B. Johnson's Great Society. Its generous subsidies for childcare and universal pre-kindergarten are designed to lift the struggling working class into a less precarious economic position. Ample housing support, more higher education aid and worker training programs in the bill would reach well into the middle class. Home and community health care, a new hearing benefit for Medicare and price controls for prescription drugs would ease the lives of older Americans. All of that could reasonably be described as big government excess, and Republicans have made that case repeatedly for months. The scope and cost of the bill, if anything, is understated by its roughly $2 trillion price tag, because Democrats kept the cost down by phasing in some measures and arbitrarily ending others well before the expiration of the bill's 10-year window, some after a single year. In all, according to the Committee for a Reasonable Budget, if the entire Build Back Better Act were made permanent, the 10-year cost would be $4.9 trillion, which would exceed the inflation-adjusted 4-year cost of the Second World War, as Kevin McCarthy charged repeatedly over 8 hours. Yet a combined assault by business organizations like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, their political operatives at groups like American Action Network, and the intense focus on the Republican Party against what they call socialist early education, crippling tax increases and dangerous limitations on drug companies was not enough to peel away even 4 House Democrats, the bare minimum that would have been needed to defeat the legislation. Competitive races next year will test whether voters embrace Republicans' grim view of the package or Democrats' belief that they are delivering vital programs that will be broadly appealing. Representative Tim Ryan, a Democrat from the working-class region of Ohio who is running for an open Senate seat, said Republicans have dug themselves a political hole by railing against the bill. They're getting themselves in a position where they're putting themselves against universal preschool. They're putting themselves against controlling childcare costs for people, putting themselves on the other side of a tax cut for families, Mr. Ryan said. You know, people have been screaming socialism for a long time, and Roosevelt got elected 4 times. The social welfare and climate bill is not yet law, but to have gotten it even this far was a prodigious feat, and what that probably happened only because of the societal and economic changes that preceded it, Democrats from across the spectrum of their party say. Look at the millennials in my district, who can't afford a house, who can't afford to pay back their student loans, who can't even dream about living the lives their parents lived, Representative John B. Larson of Connecticut, a veteran Democrat, said. You can't tell people they're doing better than they are. And as society has changed, so has the Democratic Party. Representative Jamal Bowman's New York district stretches from the wealthy suburb of Scarsdale to the tougher streets of Mount Vernon, and for 32 years was represented by a white establishment Democrat, Elliot Engel. Jamal Bowman, a progressive black man who defeated Mr. Engel in a Democratic primary last year, said his constituents acknowledge wealth inequality and income stagnation in their midst, in part because he won't let them deny it. If they try to look the other way, they really can't, Mr. Bowman said, and they know that whether it's through government or private industry or both, we have to do more to close the inequality gap. Republicans are still betting that voters will fixate on the spectacle of a Democratic president struggling for months to unite his divided majority around his agenda. They argue that the chaotic and deadly withdrawal from Afghanistan, rising inflation and unsteady economic growth have only added to a sense that the country is in a drift, and say they're not about to allow Democrats to use the society the social safety net bill to distract from these concerns. We have a supply chain crisis that continues to rage on, exacerbating the skyrocketing prices and scarcity of goods our citizens are experiencing, the House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy said on Thursday. And ask yourself this, what has this chamber done, especially this week, to alleviate any of these pressures on our fellow citizens, the people we were sent here to represent? The answer is absolutely nothing. Passage of the bill, Republicans say, will only stoke inflation, force the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates and create stagflation, the combination of stagnant economic growth and rising prices that doomed Jimmy Carter's presidency. Democrats contend that their policies will offer real relief. Economic trends indicate a need for targeted assistance to the working and middle class, and it would be paid for largely by the richest Americans and largest corporations. In 2010, a moderate Democrat was socially liberal on issues like abortion and immigration, but fiscally conservative on government spending, and many of them voted against the Affordable Care Act. Today, a new brand of Democrats have emerged who are fiscally populist, but more circumspect on progressive social causes like immigration, defunding police forces and pressing responses to racial injustice. They voted for the bill on Friday. Republicans warned that Democrats will pay a steep political price for doing so. They point to the accelerating pace of retirement announcements, the latest coming on Thursday, 18th of November, from Representative G.K. Butterfield, a senior black Democrat from North Carolina, who would face a difficult re-election if a Republican gerrymandering district map for 2022 passes court muster. Who can blame these Democrats for retiring? Kevin McCarthy asked, almost taunting them before the vote. They see the writing on the wall, and they know this reconciliation bill will be the end of their Democrat majority, and for many, their congressional careers. Mr. Butterfield, who noted he was 74 years old, said on Thursday night that he appreciated Kevin McCarthy's sense of humour. Mr. Cartwright, who in 2012 unseated a fellow Democrat in northeastern Pennsylvania because he had voted against the health law, said he did not fear the Republican attacks to come. Republicans have opposed things that help ordinary working people for generation after generation after generation, he said. They spoke of downfall of civilization when Franklin Delano Roosevelt came up with Social Security.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.